Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for tuning in to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Patient staffing ratios are a sticking point as a labor dispute between the nurses union and management at Kapi'olani Medical Center comes to a head over a new working contract. Today we hear from the Healthcare Association about the complex issue over safe patient care and mandatory ratios. We talk about e-bikes and the need for regulations to keep the public safe on our roads and sidewalks and bike lanes. And for the rest of the week, we plan to take a look at renewable energy as we look to build resilience against climate change. Today, we take you up inside a wind turbine. It's Wednesday, September 18th, the first day of our fall membership campaign. You know, the hundreds of nurses who have been locked out of their jobs for 5 days now will lose their health coverage if their dispute is not resolved by the end of the month. The Hawaii Nurses Association says it will have its 500 to 600 nurses apply for unemployment benefits and COBRA health insurance if that happens. The union says it has a strike fund, and nurses say they can be paid about $70 a day if they take part in the demonstrations. The union says a sticking point is mandatory patient-to-staff ratios. We talked to Hilton Rathel, president of the Healthcare Association of Hawaii, which represents a number of hospitals and long-term care facilities across the state, about what it looks like on the floor.
Now, running a hospital is a very, very complex operation. And there's all sorts of different things that are changing throughout shifts, throughout days, and from week to week. So there's lots of different factors. Now, what some of the unions, and this is not just happening in Hawaii, it's happening on the mainland as well. Some of the unions are saying, well, we want a fixed patient staff ratio. Well, life is just not that simple. You know, what happens on the units is you can have different types of staffing. You know, a lot of our staffing is nurses or registered nurses, RNs. But then often you have support staff as well. It could be an LPN, a licensed practical nurse, a certified nurse assistant. There's other types of staff that would be on a hospital floor as well. And then you can have, you know, RNs, someone who's new, someone who just graduated a year ago, they're going to have a lot less experience than someone who's been around for 5 years, 10 years, or 15 years. And so just on the staffing side, what type of staff you have, how many support staff you have, how long people have been there, how long they've been on that particular floor, whether it's a NICU, an ICU, a CCU, a med-surg floor, that makes a huge difference. And then on the patient side, that also makes a huge difference. So patients are not the same. So, for example, the average length of stay in Hawaii is somewhere between 5 and 6 days in a hospital. So if someone goes in for surgery, for example, the day they come out of surgery or the next day, they're going to need quite a bit of care. You've got to adjust the medications. You maybe got to, you know, change dressings. There's things you've got to do. But at the end of their stay, once they're ready to go home, they need a lot less care. I mean, because they're ready to go home, they're ready to be discharged. And then if you look at something like pneumonia, for example, pneumonia, you know, a lot of people catch pneumonia. If you've got someone who's 80 years old and has pneumonia, and they have congestive heart failure and kidney disease, they need a lot of care. They're really sick. But if you've got someone who's, say, a 40-year-old, otherwise healthy individual, and they have pneumonia, they need a different level of care. Yes, they need monitoring. They need nursing care. So
they could bounce back a lot faster.
And they could bounce back a lot faster. So you've got these two major variables that are happening. One is on the staffing side, what type of staffing, what mix of staffing you've got, how experienced staff are. And on the other side, you've got this patient load that varies. And then you've also got patients coming in and out of the hospital. You know, patients are being discharged, patients are being admitted. So the workload varies considerably throughout the shift, throughout the day, and from week to week.
And we've been hearing that, oh, there are other states that have adopted this patient staff ratio. And so, you know, what does that model look like? You know, because we've been hearing about, well, there's a matrix and, you know, based on the acuity, you know, the patient condition, that there are these decisions made about their care.
One of the things that I think that a lot of people don't understand is that the decisions that get made about how to staff units are not made by the CEO. The CEO is not sitting at his or her desk and looking at all the units and saying, okay, well, there should be 3 nurses on this unit and 5 nurses. That's not what happens. The decisions are made actually by nurses. And these are nurses who have gained some experience and they become nurse managers and they manage the nursing levels on the floor. Now, yes, there has been a few states that have adopted a fixed staff ratio, but that has not necessarily solved any problem. If you look at California, for example, who has had fixed patient staff ratios for over 20 years now, and you look at their vacancy rate, and you look at how much they pay. So California pays the highest nursing salaries in the country. We pay the second highest nursing salaries in the country. So California is the only state that pays more than us for their nurses. And they have had staffing ratios for over 20 years. And if you look at the vacancy rate that exists in California compared to the vacancy rate that exists in Hawaii, it's no better. And you look at their quality outcomes. In Hawaii, we're fortunate. We have some very, very good quality outcomes overall. You look at what happened during the pandemic, for example. We had the lowest death rate for the entire pandemic in the entire nation. Now, there's lots of factors that go into that, but one of the factors is the care that patients got in our hospitals and long-term care facilities. So we have very safe hospitals. We have committed staff. We have the nurses are phenomenal that we have. But it's actually nurse managers that make decisions to ensure that there is enough nurses or enough support staff or a mix of staff on the floor at any point in time.
One thing that I was a little hazy on is, you know, the mandatory overtime. We were hearing from some nurses that there was language in there, but management said, well, we'll only use it if we really need to. And they did use it during the pandemic. But then they said, well, we're out of the pandemic now, but they're still, you know, using the mandatory overtime. But I'm just wondering, with the patient staffing ratio, how does that work if we don't have enough nurses to fill the slots?
Well, there's different things that we can do. As the load varies, now, you normally have a certain number of staff that are rostered on, whether it's RNs, LPNs, CNAs, or whatever. You have respiratory therapists, you have PTs, OTs that are coming in to, you know, help take care of patients. Lots of different staff. But if there is a shortage, let's say, you know, you get a flu going around and you got a few nurses that call out sick because, you know, they just can't come to work or they've got COVID, for example.
Right.
Then there's different options that these nurse managers have, the nurse managers who actually manage the load on the unit. First thing they could do, as many people know, a lot of nurses work 3 12-hour shifts a week, which means they have 4 days off a week. So one of the first things you can do is you can call up some of these nurses or put a call out and say, look, you know, we're short on this unit. Are you willing to come in and pick up an extra shift? So that's one thing you can do. Another thing you could do is you could actually just ask staff who are working, are you able to work another 2 hours, 4 hours? And just ask them voluntarily. Another option you have is there are staffing agencies that exist in Hawaii. And there are quite a few people who don't want to work full-time that may be RNs, but they're willing to work part-time. They're willing to be called in, so on-call staffing. So that's another option you've got. And if you do know that there is going to be a significant surge or you're anticipating something, what you can do is bring nurses or travelers in from the mainland. And so there's a variety of options that are available to our hospitals. All of those options get used almost every single day or every single week.
A couple of nights ago, I was looking at the state-by-state comparison with the ratios and then also the vacancies. And some states, I was amazed to see they had a surplus. So I was like, wow, how do we get in that category, right?
Well, one way to do that would be to reduce the cost of living and cut the price of housing in half.
Mm-hmm.
As we all know, it's very expensive to live in Hawaii. And that's a huge challenge. It's a huge challenge for our hospitals. It's a huge challenge for our city, our county government. Everyone's looking for workers. And unfortunately, we have a material number of young people who leave every year because they can't see a path forward here in Hawaii, cannot see a future here. So even though we do pay very well, and for many professions, we do pay very well, the cost of living is a huge factor. The cost of housing is a huge factor. Mm-hmm. The cost of gas is a huge factor. You know, the cost of a gallon of milk is a significant factor. So there are some states where the cost of living is a lot better. You pay less for gas. You pay half for what you pay in Hawaii for a house or even less than that, you know, to get
right.
a very nice house.
Yeah, and that's why everybody leaves. The nurses, the doctors, the hotel workers.
Yeah.
You see that. So as this labor dispute plays out with Kapi'olani, and I know the other hospitals are also in various states of negotiation, I don't know, any final thoughts that you want to just leave our listeners with as we try to understand this complex issue?
Well, nursing is an incredible profession. It takes a huge amount of dedication, a lot of skill, a lot of training to become a nurse. And we have phenomenal nurses here in Hawaii, and the statistics speak to that. Unfortunately, we've got this labor action that's going on right now. But what we all have to realize is at the end of the day, we all have to work together. You know, there's not a lot of choices in terms of hospitals, you know, of where to work. There's a small number of choices. We've got to figure out how to work together. And one, you know, some people are talking about these big corporations, like there are these big, greedy, faceless organizations. The corporations that run our hospitals, they're people who live and work here in Hawaii. They're all of our hospitals are not-for-profit. No one is trying to fill the pockets of shareholders or is concerned about stock prices. The people that are running our hospitals are people who live here in Hawaii, who work in Hawaii, who want to take care of the people of Hawaii.
That was Hilton Rathel of the Healthcare Association of Hawaii talking about the labor dispute playing out at Kapi'olani Medical Center for Women and Children. The two sides are set to go back face-to-face at the bargaining table tomorrow.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, committed to supporting Native Hawaiians impacted by the Maui wildfires. Applications for its Kanaho grant accepted through October 10th at oha.org/kanaho-grant. Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health, also known as HIOSH, committed to the people of Hawaii, working to help keep workplaces safe and protect employees' rights. More by searching HIOSH.
The city says there is at least one 911 call for an accident with an e-bike just about every day. We talked to John Noucci, the deputy director of the city's Department of Transportation Services, recently about a bill under consideration to regulate the different types of electrified vehicles on the roads and sidewalks. Here's Noucci.
Part of the challenge with e-bikes is just the classification, right? If I say e-bikes, you and I might think of completely different things. And I think even for when you look at the people that have to enforce laws on our roadways for our police officers, it's hard for them to figure out what is an actual registered e-bike and what is, say, an electric dirt bike or recreational vehicle that is traveling on our city streets. Because, you know, like dirt bikes and those electric dirt bikes are not street legal. They don't have certain things that would help them become street legal, such as lighting, turn signals, horns, or other safety features. And so I think at first blush, it is just really hard to distinguish the different types of vehicles and types of things we have on the road. We have one wheels, we have electric skateboards, we have, you know, these like wheels with pegs on them that people are riding around. I even saw, you know, on the social media, people always they're getting extra attention for people like kind of jury-rigging like beach chairs to like a deck of a one wheel and then riding, you know, through town on it. And I think that kind of madness, we need to kind of get in front of it and figure out a good regulatory structure that makes sense, that is enforceable and is concurrent with what's going on at the state legislature. So I think, you know, Bill 52, I think, is a great time for us to take in a lot of public comment about e-bikes and how people feel about e-bikes and maybe how the current regulations are structured around those. And it comes at a very good time because the legislature will open for 2025 at the beginning of the year. And then perhaps we can work with our state legislature partners to come up with a coherent organization within the traffic code. And then the city ordinance and the state laws will mesh together in a very usable, user-friendly, enforceable fashion.
Well, you know, I was on King Street not too long ago and saw some newfangled thing. It was actually an electric scooter, and somebody in a wheelchair had jerry-rigged their wheelchair onto it. It turned heads. Even somebody that was on a bicycle stopped, because we were stopped at the traffic light, and they were just amazed, like this person was in the bike lane, but it was scary.
Yeah, and it's hard. You know, I think at this time, we want to take a look at our city ordinances because, you know, I mean, sometimes things happen in our history that end up being more blips in pop culture than they are in long-lasting senses. Like, if you look at our state traffic code, you'll see things like, we refer to Segways a lot, but Segways aren't necessarily, you know, as the self-balancing Segway mechanism that we saw that was popular in the early 2000s, we don't see too many of those anymore, but they have a place in the state traffic code, and I think in the city, you can use those on the sidewalk, but they cannot exceed 8 miles an hour, and there's all these rules that are built around it. Likewise, you see, I think one Christmas, there was a big proliferation of the gasoline power Razor scooter. That's also reflected in our ordinance, too. And we're still trying to figure out how do we write electric foot scooters into our local ordinances now that they're enabled in a category in the state traffic code. So I think that sort of shaking out what has more permanence and what is more of a fad, we want to make a less temporary snapshot of vehicles or devices that are on the road and kind of take that into account. And again, it's a good opportunity for us to do that in front of state law because then, you know, the state law is more broad and overarching. Our city and county laws can be more restrictive than the state laws.
Right. And then each county is different.
Right. So I think we would definitely design things that work for the city and county of Honolulu and our urban density that might not be present in other places. But that being said, our legislative analyst here at DTS is working closely together with the other three counties. I think they're following what we do. They want to take a look at what makes sense for us. And nobody's into reinventing the wheel as all these wheels are being reinvented into new devices. So I think we all want to keep an eye on what each county is doing and then figure out how we can then work with our state legislature to enact something or revise the traffic code to make sense of maybe even what we see coming in the future and revise those definitions to something that makes sense.
Well, you know, as we're having this conversation, I'm thinking of what happened when Uber and Lyft started to appear on the scene. And we saw it coming, you know, it was happening not just on the mainland, but in countries across the globe. And we had to deal with our taxi laws, right? What kind of animal is it? Who regulates it? Is it PUC? Is it city and county? I also think of like the Department of Land and Natural Resources with watercraft, you know, with the surfboards and the advent of kite surfing. And then you have these motorized surfboards. So there's different animals. And then you had the people that designed those jet packs, the water jet packs.
Those water jet packs, yeah.
Right. And our regulations couldn't keep up with the technology.
So you know what I think is interesting? When rideshare, Uber and Lyft kind of came into town or when they were proliferating on the continent and other places in the world, right? I think that there was a great pride on behalf of the rideshare companies to come in and say that they were disrupting a long-standing industry. That there was a sense of badge of courage and badge of honor that, you know, a tech bro startup was coming in and disrupting large-scale transportation operations in many cities. But, you know, I think people have tired of that term of disruptor. And when it comes down to it, I think when you saw that bite back at people was when Lime tried to do the same thing about micro-mobility in cities, and they deployed in many cities, as did other small providers, micro-transit providers.
Yeah, they went rogue.
Everybody went rogue. But you know what's funny? The appetite, let's just say 10 to 12 years different between Uber and Lyft and ride-sharing to the scooter side, people were not as appreciative of that level of disruption. And now there's kind of a negative connotation around the tech bro image, you know, that startup image.
Well, I just worry about safety. I mean, we saw some elementary schools just flat out say, no, you cannot use e-bikes because it's dangerous, you know. And then the whole issue of helmets. The other day I was, you know, leaving work, coming down the ramp, and there was somebody on a electric scooter. And while I can see, I've got, you know, great mirrors on either side. Boy, they just come up so fast, and I could have taken him out. It was scary, very
right.
scary.
And, you know, you bring up a really good point is that these users, they may not have an idea of how they look to other users of the roadway. And that is a very true statement now. I think nowadays, especially in our younger adults, we have less younger adults that are choosing to drive. So maybe a lot of them have not even gotten their license, you know, a driver's license. And maybe they don't need to, but there is some value in everyone learning how to operate a vehicle, or more so learning how they look to other vehicles and other people using the roadway.
Yeah, maybe limited, you know, line of sight. But this person was on the sidewalk. I don't think he was supposed to going that fast.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, you think about that too, right? So, I mean, even taking that a little bit farther, right? Like a child riding a bike in a neighborhood, right? They'll ride on the sidewalk, and that's just the way kids grow up. But I would guarantee that most kids riding on the sidewalk don't know how they look to a car that is backing out of a driveway that they're going to cross paths with so that the car can get onto the roadway. And so there needs to be awareness on both sides, more particularly for the users of the automobile who have the bigger vehicle and have the potential to cause more serious injury. But there is a shared responsibility. I think, you know, if you're riding a bike or something, anything that is not a vehicle, I think, you know, you kind of need to know how you're going to look, how other people can see you, or how in a blink of an eye, they won't see you, and something pretty tragic or fatal could happen. And that's kind of what DTS is trying to chew on now with our Vision Zero program and our Complete Streets program. Is we're going to create equity across the roadway for all users, and yet we have to figure out the safest way for everyone to coexist.
And that was John Nucci, Deputy Director of the City's Department of Transportation, talking to us about the need to regulate e-bikes and other electrified vehicles across the state.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
For today's Mono Minute, we have the call of Hawaii's would-be woodpecker. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
Akeapola owl are large, bright yellow honey creepers that act like woodpeckers. They use their strong lower bill to peck holes in the branches of trees. Then they use their long, curved upper bill to pry out the tasty insect larvae. There are less than 2,000 of these birds left, mainly because of habitat loss and mosquito-transmitted avian malaria. And nowadays, their song can only be heard in high-elevation koa forests on the Big Island, where it's too cold for mosquitoes. In addition to controlling mosquitoes, planting koa forests would be a great way to increase populations of this very rare and important species. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Biology Department at UH Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Evergreen by Deborah, featuring HydroFlow permeable pavers. At evergreenbydeborah.com, learn more about how HydroFlow pavers are designed to allow rainwater to find its way back to the island's aquifers and reduce runoff.
Bird and bat strikes were a big concern about the large wind turbines that began appearing on our landscape across the state. Recently, we took a trip to tour the newest wind turbines out in Kahuku. It was not at all what I expected. It was surprisingly quiet. AES Hawaii operates Napua Makani, the renewable energy project in Kahuku. It generates enough power for 16,000 homes. That's 24 megawatts of green energy. It's a key part to the state reaching its goal of 100% renewable energy by 2045, and that's in about 20 years. The 8 turbines can be turned off in a New York minute and are monitored 24 hours a day with teams located here on Oahu as well as on the mainland. Tyler Bostian took us up inside one turbine, which sports a new system designed to deter bats from the area. We're told it would take about 20 minutes to climb up to the top of the turbine, or less than half that with an assisted hoist. It is a very long way up, about 40 stories high.
You only really need to get up there if you're doing maintenance, right?
Correct. Like, we're in charge of the bat modules I was talking about, the FAA lights, the red blinky lights at night. If we have to change those out or that, yeah, we have to climb the turbine. And then at the very top, We have a chain hoist that comes down. It takes about 10, 15 minutes to get down, and we pick our tools up that way and bring them up. This is our computer. So I can put it in maintenance, right? We're in pause. I was telling you how they yaw. I can make it yaw. So right now the top of the whole thing is spinning. It's very slow. It takes like 20 minutes, right? But this is monitoring 6,800 different signals. But there's over almost 800 alarms. Some of them will shut it down. Some of them will just give you a change color. You know, like it turned yellow, it could turn blue if there's a warning, that kind of thing. Or if it shuts down, it goes red. And of those 788, 188 alarms will automatically shut it down and require someone to go check things out. Doesn't happen very often, I would say, but these are serviced annually. After the service, we do what we call service audits on them, so we're climbing. I mean, turbines are getting climbed every week, but I mean, as far as maintenance that's required, it's only annually unless something, one of those alarms pops up.
We also talked to Sandra Larson, president of AES Hawaii, about the project and its recent success in reducing the threat to Hawaii's endangered birds and mammals, in particular, our native hoary bat. Here's Larson.
The wind turbines, when it's windy at night and during the day, they're able to produce, you know, as long as it's windy. So it is really complements the solar facilities that we have on the island. So for us, on Oahu, particularly to get to 100%, it's really important that we have a diverse mix of renewable resources.
And then you have tried to minimize what you can. You've got underground cabling as part of this whole picture.
Yes. So as you saw, really, there's only one space when we're up kind of by the Met Tower area where it is above ground. But all the rest of it is underground and really trying to be good neighbors to the land and to our neighbors. And we do share the site with all of these farmers. Kahuku Farm, which is right down the road, is one of the big farmers in the area. And we are, you know, very supportive of them and supportive of all of the farmers in the area. So, you know, we want to give back to the community. We are working with the city on building and developing in partnership the Kahuku District Park to have a pool and a rec center. And it's something that we've been talking with the city for a while. And I'm actually really happy to be able to say that we've come to an agreement on how we'll work in partnership. And we have had originally committed $4 million to this project and recently have committed an additional million. So we're going to be putting $5 million into the project with the city. We'll use the funds to design and plan the whole pool project, and then also construct phase one.
So it's all part of the idea of the community impact fee.
Yeah. I mean, there's a mandated community benefits from some of our RFP3, which is the third request for proposal projects. But this was really something that was through discussions with the community and with our landowner and really identifying longstanding community need. There was a real desire originally to have a rec center. And then, you know, through discussions, the mayor and the community, they came to an understanding that they really want a pool. I think the community has been waiting for a really long time for a pool in this area. And so being able to bring that all together has been something that we've worked really hard to do.
You know, there was a lot of pushback at the beginning for this project. I know they have the other wind project over in, on the other side. And there was a lot of concern for the bird strikes and the bat strikes. So what's the snapshot? What can you tell us about, you know, the hoary bat and any of the fatalities since you've been operational?
We do a lot. You know, we talked a lot about the conservation dogs that come every week and they do a search across all of the property. And we have a bat deterrent mechanism, I guess, on the turbines that sends out ultrasonic. You can't hear it with the human ear, but the bats can hear it and that will keep them away from the turbine. So we found that it's been very, very effective since the start of the project, which has now been in operation since December of 2020. We've only had one bat strike. So, you know, it's been really effective and the team does a really good job of just, you know, searching and making sure that we are being diligent and making sure that we're mitigating any impact on wildlife.
And so this is really your only wind project, but you see it as what, underscoring just the need to have something else besides solar.
it's important to diversify. You know, solar is great. We're in a state where we have plenty of sunshine, but it also takes up land. And we're certainly working on several utility scale solar projects, and we are looking at ways to partner with agriculture and have agricultural dual use at the sites. But as you see from this site, it really isn't more effective use of the land in the sense that you're having a much smaller footprint. Visually, you do have that impact, and they are large and you do see them. But I think I do remember Senator Schatz talking about for Hawaii to get to 100% renewable, we're going to see it. That's just the reality of having some of these projects in our islands, and that's how we will work towards mitigating climate change, and that's the biggest crisis of our time. And so we really need, as an island, to move towards sustainability and resiliency for our islands, and you know, having these clean, renewable resources is really important for us to get there.
And then I know that there's a bill that's making its way through the city council, I think, and you folks submitted testimony.
So Bill 64, it's gone through multiple iterations. One of the things that we're concerned about is, so it's proposing in its current form that there would be a 1.25 mile setback from residential zoning for these wind projects. We're concerned about, one, if that's implemented, it would eliminate wind facilities across the island. But more importantly, if there's not a grandfathering clause included, that would mean when these projects, and our project still has 17 more years to go, but there's projects, neighboring projects that will probably be coming up in a shorter time frame. That's about 125 megawatts across this area. If the projects are not allowed to continue operating, that's 125 megawatts that comes off of our grid. And that means, one, we're stepping backwards as we're trying to get to 100% renewable. And secondly, then you have to expend millions of dollars to bring on new projects. And that then goes into costs for ratepayers or customers who are paying electricity. So this whole goal of working towards reducing our electricity by having renewable resources, if we have to continue rebuilding from new projects, it's going to take much longer to get to a place where we're bringing those costs down. To get to 100%, we need to continue to have operating projects in existence that are utilizing renewable resources.
There's talk of possibly an offshore wind project, and folks were a little bit apprehensive, you know, because there are so few right now operating in the U.S. The Atlantic, I think, is maybe one, I think. Yeah. Europe is farther along than we are in that regard. But you're from here. I mean, you know how sensitive people are about the environment. Yeah. But at the same time, there's give and take.
Yeah, there's definitely a give and take. I mean, you're right. And all of us, we have almost 60 people in AES Hawaii on the ground who live locally. We're all residents of the communities. We live here. We work here. We want to do what's right for our aina. We also want to be able to have our kids continue to stay here and live here and their kids stay here. My kids are on the mainland because it's become very difficult to make a living here. So that's a lot of what we're all working towards. You know, the team that I work with is incredibly passionate about bringing these projects online so we can start moving the needle towards an island that's more sustainable, that is more affordable, that's more resilient. And it's really about creating a future for our kids and continuing to have an island home that is where we want to live and stay.
That was Sandra Larson, who is with AES Hawaii, talking about the Napua Makani Wind Project out in Kahuku. It's been in operation since 2020, and Larson says during that time, it has only had a single hoary bat strike, thanks to the installation of a new bat deterrent system. We're told, based on its success, an older neighboring wind farm is installing something similar. And that is it for our show today.